It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
It's official. Former Army Chief Abdel Fattah el-Sisi is Egypt's president-elect. The United States prepares to send an ambassador to Somalia. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Official results from Egypt's presidential election of last week show former Army Chief Abdel Fattah el-Sisi winning the presidency by a landslide. The Election Commission Tuesday said Mr. Sisi took nearly 97% of the vote in last week's race. That prompted thousands to take to the streets to celebrate with cheers, fireworks, and pro-military songs. Among the celebrants, Iman Adli. She says she's happy Mr. Sisi won and happier still the army is now ruling the country. Glad to be rid of the Muslim Brotherhood. The most important thing, she says, is regaining security and ending Brotherhood protests. It's estimated that 47% of Egypt's 54 million eligible voters took part in the poll, less than the 52% turnout secured during the 2012 election that placed Mohamed Morsi into power. Mr. Sisi was all but assured of victory before the vote, but had called for a turnout large enough to give him a mandate to fix the economy and end the country's political turmoil. In Libya, outgoing Prime Minister Abdullah El-Thani says he is prepared to give up power to his successor, Ahmed Ma'itik, who convened a cabinet meeting Monday. Mr. Thani had resigned in April, but indicated he's uncertain of the legitimacy of the parliamentary vote for Mr. Ma'itik and awaits a court ruling on the matter. 3 years after the ouster of dictator Muammar Gaddafi and lacking democratic institutions, Libya has been convulsed in fighting among rival militia and political factions. Mr. Ma'itik is the fifth prime minister in the country since Gaddafi's ouster in 2011. Meanwhile, former General Khalifa Haftar and his so-called National Army have been battling Islamist militia. On Monday in Benghazi, at least 22 people reportedly killed, dozens more wounded. People in Malawi have been assured they'll see a change in the governing style of the now ruling Democratic Progress Party, DPP, which was returned to power following last month's contested election under new leader Peter Mutharika, who received just 37% of the vote. Under his late brother, former President Bingu wa Mutharika, people experienced acute shortages of fuel and foreign exchange, as well as rising prices for goods and services. Lamek Messina reports.
The new president directly addressed those concerns in his inaugural speech Monday. He promised Malawians a change in leadership style.
Those of you who have been worried, I can assure you that the DPP has changed. And therefore, we have learned from the past.
But he said his administration will renew some policies of the former DPP administration, including initiatives for greater food production, development of rural areas, and empowerment of women. President Mutharika takes power after a corruption scandal known as Cashgate and a disputed election that was challenged by the outgoing president, Joyce Banda. Mr. Mutharika called for unity among Malawians in helping him to rebuild the country. President Mutharika invited all 11 other presidential candidates to help him rebuild the country, promising to approach them one by one in the near future. He also said his administration will have a 20-member cabinet, half the size of previous governments, to cut down on spending. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
The United States is going to name its first ambassador to Somalia in more than 20 years. Undersecretary for Political Affairs Wendy Sherman made the announcement Tuesday at the Washington-based U.S. Institute of Peace.
The United States has not had a formal ambassador to Mogadishu since we closed our mission on January 5, 1991. I can tell you today that this will be changing.
She said the Obama administration came to the decision to reinstate an ambassador in Mogadishu based on its deepening relationship with the country and its, quote, faith that better times are ahead. The telecommunications ministry in Central African Republic says text messaging is now considered a security threat and its use suspended. The decision reportedly made by the country's prime minister amid a resurgence of violence in the capital, Bangui. Local South African media say the government is offering a wage proposal to end a crippling four-month platinum mine strike. It offers a 7.5-month wage hike backdated to 2013, the plan roughly equivalent to one offered by three platinum companies to striking union workers. The union has demanded a more than doubling of the basic monthly wage. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Wednesday, June 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. What does President Obama's recent foreign policy speech mean for Africa?
When I heard his speech, what occurred to me is that he's almost talking about an Africanization of security policy, because the kind of strategies that he's talking about sounds an awful lot like the strategies that the Obama administration has been using in Africa for the last several years.
Bronwyn Broughton is the deputy director of the Africa Center at the U.S.-based Atlantic Council. A South Sudan member of parliament defected to the rebels. Former Zimbabwe Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai denies reports he's been ill. And Nigeria's main opposition APC party says it is not a Boko Haram sympathizer.
Anywhere in the world, insurgencies are not overcome without dialogue. Is that the same thing as saying that we support Boko Haram?
Lau Mohammed is a spokesman for Nigeria's opposition All Progressive Congress Party. Tens of thousands of African migrants have been rescued this year while crossing the sea into Italy. And a new report warns of midwives shortages. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An Africa analyst says she does not expect to hear a lot about human rights issues in Africa during the upcoming U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit in Washington, D.C. in the first week of August. Bronwyn Broughton, deputy director of the Africa Center at the U.S.-based Atlantic Council, also says she's concerned that the summit might disappoint many of the African leaders if each of them does not get a face-to-face meeting with President Barack Obama to talk specifically about what the United States can do for each country. On President Obama's recent foreign policy speech, Broughton tells me the speech sounded to her as if the president was proposing the Africanization of U.S. security policy.
When I heard his speech, what occurred to me is that he's almost talking about an Africanization of security policy, because the kind of strategies that he's talking about applying to Ukraine and to Syria sounds an awful lot like the strategies that the Obama administration has been using in Africa for the last several years. What that is working very closely with partner African governments, for example, to deal with the terrorist threats, and working closely with UN troop contributing countries to make sure that they're equipped to provide peacekeepers to countries in crisis. And then at the same time also being prepared to deploy U.S. special forces when it's absolutely necessary to do so.
The focus on terrorism, does that put Africa in the center of U.S. foreign policy with the emerging Al-Shabaab and the Boko Haram in Nigeria?
Well, Africa's always been on the radar in terms of the emerging terror threat. There are a number of people who see Africa as the final frontier for Al-Qaeda. But I don't think that Africa is at the moment very, very high on the list of priorities in terms of the war on terrorism. Al-Shabaab is definitely a very real concern to U.S. policymakers because it's launched a number of major terror attacks. And the threat that it poses in Kenya, for example, is considered so severe that the U.S. has had to restrict the size of its embassy. But the other threats on the continent, the threats in Mali, the ones emanating from Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, for example, I think are still largely theoretical. The administration is worried about Boko Haram, but I think that it's worried mostly about Boko Haram as a local threat to stability in Nigeria, not so much at this point as an Al-Qaeda affiliate.
The U.S.-Africa summit, there's been some suggestion that perhaps the administration should try to bring up, let's say, issues like human rights abuses in Africa. I guess that's off the table.
You know, it's not been a focus of the Obama administration, period. So I don't expect to hear a lot about human rights during the upcoming African Leaders Summit. I'm also concerned that the summit might disappoint expectations if a lot of these leaders don't get some real face time with President Obama while they're in the country, and not just, you know, en masse altogether, you know, some close to 50 leaders sitting in a room with one American president, but, you know, really face-to-face conversations about what the United States can do in each individual country in Africa.
Bronwyn Broughton is the Deputy Director of the Africa Center at the U.S.-based Atlantic Council. She was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. Nigerian police say protesters are free to march in the capital, Abuja, a day after the police appeared to ban demonstrations in support of the more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram. Meanwhile, a prominent member of Nigeria's main opposition All Progressives Congress Party, APC, has resigned from the party after accusing senior members of the group of being supporters and sympathizers of the Islamic militant group Boko Haram. Local media reports say Femi Fani Kayode, a former aviation minister, has since rejoined President Goodluck Jonathan's ruling People's Democratic Party, the PDP. But Lyle Mohammed, spokesman for the opposition APC, tells reporter Peter Clarty, Femi Kayode was never a leading member of the party.
My grounds with Femi is very simple. I said he was never a leader of my party. He was never a member of the interim ESCO of the party, was never a member of the Elders Council, was never a member of the National Caucus of the party. How then does he qualify to be a leader of my party? Yes, he has access to a few of our leaders, but that does not automatically confer on him leadership of the party.
When he left the PDP and joined the APC, he did that with much fanfare and he was embraced by everybody else. So saying that he doesn't belong or he's not a leader of the party is questionable.
That's not correct. For us in APC, he is not just a factor. But you see, unfortunately in politics, you don't drive away anybody. Now, as to the allegation of whether we are supporters of APC or not, unfortunately, this is the same mindset of the president that has led Nigeria to this sorry pass. Now, but because PDP has lost credibility, all they do now is tag everybody being a pro-Boko Haram. Now, I begin to ask them, if I, Lai Mohammed, am a supporter of Boko Haram, what is your evidence? What is your proof? And why am I still walking the streets free?
Critics of APC who say that you have been on record and many members of the APC have been on record that members of Boko Haram should be treated like the Niger Delta militants, despite the fact that Boko Haram members have killed so many Nigerians. Not only that, but for them to be proscribed as a militant or a terrorist group, the APC opposed to.
Absolutely false. And I challenge anybody to come out and say where my party or I said so. Now, it is true that my party said there's no way you can win this war without dialogue. And anywhere in the world, insurgencies are not overcome without dialogue. Is that the same thing as saying that we support Boko Haram?
Is it true that the APC has politicized the issue of the terrorism activities being perpetrated by Boko Haram instead of joining hands to come together as a nation to resolve this problem that has become a global menace to everybody?
If anybody has politicized the Boko Haram insurgency, it is the PDP and President Jonathan, pure and simple. Because if you remember, in the wake of the Inyanya blast, which killed over 70 people, within 2 hours, the PDP came out with a statement saying that it is the handiwork of the opposition.
Lyle Mohammed is the spokesman for Nigeria's opposition All Progressives Congress Party, the APC. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. In Zimbabwe, the leader of the Movement for Democratic Change, Morgan Tsvangirai, says he feels good and is back at work. Some media outlets claim Tsvangirai had a terminal illness. A few days ago, there were even reports that he had been airlifted to Botswana as his health had reportedly taken a turn for the worse. In an exclusive interview with VOA Studio 7 program for Zimbabwe, Tsvangirai says he is healthy and even played a round of golf.
Well, I had a temporary problem, which the doctor advised against being active. So he prescribed that we should stay at home. I am surprised that some of the comments and the conclusions have nothing to do with my health condition. I'm now back. I'm fully recovered. I'm not a stone. I'm a human being. So the doctor advised that I should take it easy for a while.
So we can safely say you are back now.
I'm back at work. I was at work yesterday just to dispel some of the speculations about Tsvangirai collapsing again and going in the hospital again. And I was at work today, so I actually had a golf game.
The Herald newspaper has been reporting that you had an emotional and mental breakdown and you tried to avoid paying your hospital bills. You have denied these reports and said you will sue the Herald for slander. How far have you gone with that?
We know what the Herald's mission is, and as far as I am concerned, the hospital has paid its bills. All this speculation about running away without paying bills is defamatory. How can a man of my position sneak out of a hospital without paying bills? And especially where you are escorted out of the hospital by the hospital staff, by the hospital security. As far as any other action is concerned, we are still consulting with our lawyers on that.
And turning to the party, the last time we spoke, your former Secretary General Tendai Biti and several other members had attempted to kick you out of the party, saying you had deviated from the party principle and you were no longer fit to lead. How would you describe the state of your party at the moment? Are you still firmly in charge?
The party has recovered from the turbulence caused by this unfortunate incident for ambitious people. We have not deviated from any of our principles. The NDC is committed to democratic process and fighting for democracy in the country. And in this instance, internally in the party, the only democratic process where people are bestowed with any mandate is through the Congress. I don't see any other process other than the people giving you the mandate, not usurping the people's mandate. So as far as I'm concerned, the party has recovered from the turbulence. Obviously, resources are limited. But that doesn't mean that we are not able to engage in our activities.
That was former Zimbabwe Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai speaking with Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe program. It is Wednesday morning, June 4th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. A member of South Sudan's parliament from Western Equatorial State has defected to join rebels allied to former Vice President Riek Machar. Richard Mollard says South Sudan's security agents were following his activities and that he felt his life was in danger. Mollard says he defected to the rebels because of what he calls dictatorial tendencies in President Salva Kiir's administration.
I was very insecure in my hometown of Mundri. The government had deployed us and mobilized the communities for National Army. When I was in Mundri during the mobilization on the 6th of May this year, there was an attempt to make me disappear by the security organs of the government. So I had to run for my life. I'm now in Nairobi, Kenya.
When you say there was an attempt to make you disappear, can you explain that a little bit?
The security personnel were running after me. They wanted to arrest me. And I believe if they had done so, they would have just killed me or lynched me the way they did to Abraham.
What did you do that deserves an arrest?
I really didn't do anything at all. We were all mobilizing. We were about 7 from Greater Mundri. We were together. But I don't know the reason why I was singled out to be arrested. But when I learned that my life was in danger, and because I was amongst my community, and they were also aware that now my life was in danger, I had to run away.
In Nairobi, we understand that you've joined the rebels allied to former Vice President Dr. Riek Machar.
I have to do so because now I'm seeing there is too much dictatorship in Juba, and that this dictatorship needs to be removed. And the only way to remove it is by joining the opposition.
But other people will argue that as a member of parliament, you have a perfect platform to impeach the president if you think he is dictatorial. Why would you opt to carry up arms?
If my own life was in danger, how could I survive to come and speak in parliament? If insecurity is the main problem.
And how many other MPs are having the same problem like you?
In Nairobi, we are over 10 or 15 MPs here. They are all very insecure.
Have these MPs all joined the rebel organization, or what are they doing in Nairobi?
I think they have all joined the opposition because I showed them during the press conference being addressed by Riek Machar, and we sat together with them. And they were all expressing anger, indignation, and that is the majority position against the current government.
Richard Mollard is a former member of South Sudan's parliament who says he has defected to the rebel side. He spoke with John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus program. The International Organization for Migration reports that tens of thousands of migrants have been rescued while making the perilous sea crossing from Libya to Italy this year. The agency attributes this to a rescue operation initiated by Italy in late 2013. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
This past weekend, more than 3,000 boat people who crossed the Mediterranean from North Africa managed to reach Italy. Their arrival in Sicily put the number of migrants who have successfully made this perilous journey to more than 40,000 in the first 5 months of this year. That is close to the 42,000 total for all of 2013, reported by the International Organization for Migration. Most arrive in Italy from Libya, often in unsafe smugglers' boats. IOM spokeswoman Christiane Bertillon says the dramatic rescue of some 40,000 boat people this year is a result of the so-called Mare Nostrum operation started by Italy in October. She says this followed the tragic drowning of nearly 400 people when their boat caught fire and nobody was there to help.
They have huge ships that patrol the Mediterranean Sea, even in international waters, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They take the boat people, they rescue them. On this boat, they have medical facilities, they have staff that are trained to help those people, and they bring them to Sicily.
IOM says the more than 3,000 migrants rescued on Friday and Saturday included Syrians, Moroccans, Egyptians, Eritreans, Somalis, Nigerians, and other sub-Saharan nationals. The migrants told their rescuers they did not want to stay in Libya because of insecurity, so they set out for Italy, many hoping to go on from there to other European countries. Bertillon says it is very difficult to stop people from taking the perilous journey across the Mediterranean despite the risks.
And you have all these young people in the south who are fleeing violence, but not only violence. Most of them, the big majority, are migrants that are fleeing poverty and are ready to take incredible risk to get a better life for them and for their children. You know, one has to be highly desperate to take one of those boats and even bring with him his wife and his children and risk the life of all the family. It's because they're very desperate.
IOM says permanent solutions must be found to end irregular migration. The agency says it is up to the countries of origin, transit, and destination to enact policies to manage and regularize migration for the benefit of all. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A new report says there is a severe shortage of midwives in more than 70 countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. It says those countries suffer 96% of the world's maternal deaths and more than 90% of stillbirths and newborn deaths. VOA's Jody Kapua reports.
The report is a joint publication of the UN Population Fund, the International Confederation of Midwives, the World Health Organization, and others. Population Fund Executive Director Dr. Babatunde Osotimehin.
Midwives are the unsung heroes of maternal newborn health. Indeed, they are the unsung heroes for public health in the world.
Also on hand for the release of the State of the World's Midwifery 2014 report was Frances Day Sterk, president of the Midwives Confederation.
Addressing the shortages of midwives and midwifery services across low- and middle-income countries could save the lives of millions of women and newborns each year. And the report calls for urgent investment in high-quality midwifery care to prevent about two-thirds of all maternal and newborn deaths, millions of lives saved.
The report says investing in midwifery education and training would help close what it calls glaring gaps in maternal and newborn health care. And the return on the investment, it says, would be huge.
Midwives can perform about 87 to 90% of the essential care for women and newborns, but only when they're educated to global standards.
This year's midwifery report is titled A Universal Pathway, A Woman's Right to Health. It says that countries should consider the availability, accessibility, acceptability, and quality of the midwifery workforce in order to provide quality services. It goes on to say that many countries have begun taking bold steps to improve midwifery.
Saving those lives does not only mean preventing personal tragedies for families. It also means more productivity for the women and the babies who survive and thrive and the babies who grow into healthy adults.
UNFPA Chief Osotimehin says all women need and deserve respectful, compassionate care before, during, and after pregnancy and birth. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. African champions Nigeria and Greece drew 0-0 in a FIFA World Cup build-up match in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania State in the United States of America on Wednesday. Today, Thursday, Ivory Coast play El Salvador. Algeria engage Romania as Egypt play Jamaica in friendly matches. In Sudan, Kenya's AFC Leopards and Uganda's Victoria University play the Council of East and Central Africa Football Association's Sekafa Nile Basin Tournament Final in Khartoum today, Wednesday. Sudan's El Ahli Shandi face Burundi's Akademi Chite in the bronze medal playoff. Turning to athletics, South Africa's most accomplished hurdler, Gert Potgieter, met the country's elite hurdlers at the University of Pretoria on Wednesday. A retired policeman, he set the world record in 440 yards hurdles three times between 1957 and 1960 and had these words of wisdom for his grandchildren in the event.
I'm so delighted that I've been part and parcel of the development of the high culture of performance here at the University of Pretoria. My whole idea today was to try to explain the importance of achievement, not to the expense, you know, of the materialistic things, or the expense of the mental mind, which should always be fair, and that it should be based on ethical codes, and that they should put their sights very high to try and achieve the best in the world.
You took part, your pride, at a very different time in the 1950s, at the heart of apartheid when the country was segregated and it also affected sports. In just a nutshell, what was the experience like then, which is different today?
Well, today we have the privilege to experience democracy. In my days, in the heart, you know, there was no democracy. We lived separately, and there were laws, you know, that prohibited us actually to mix socially. So the spontaneousness wasn't there. There wasn't much spontaneous mixing. And then I became very unpopular as I addressed all these irregularities in government. But today it's wonderful, you know, to mix spontaneous, and that there's no discrimination, that we live in equal rights.
That was South Africa's Gert Potgieter, former world record holder in 440 yards hurdles, speaking in the South African capital, Tshwane. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a great day. Here's our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, June 4th.
I wish to thank the Nigerian Minister of Internal Affairs, Mr. Abamoro, for that discovery. A top military personnel in Nigerian Army at the top of Boko Haram. It is a welcome development and it's a very nice discovery for the Nigerian government in the fight against insurgency in Nigeria. Comrade Marley Patrick Okoro Kraft, Old Blue Village, Atame, Arasugu in Abia State, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. That's it for this Wednesday, June 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing everybody in Africa a very good day. And please stay tuned for International Edition next on The Voice of America.
Love African music?
Music time in Africa.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900 2000 and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.